March 10th, 2005. My name is Peter Scales, history student, and this is interview number two with Brigadier General retired Lloyd Scallon. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, Peter. Thank you.
I'd like to start where we left off in our interview yesterday. For 2 years, from September 77 to July 1979, you were the deputy commander of 24th NORAD region in Syracuse, New York. As I understand from your biography, you had 35 Canadian personnel and you were closely tied to the command structure of the NORAD agreement. Do you recall, first of all, if you could tell me a little bit about what the mission was at Syracuse?
Well, as with each of the NORAD regions, there was a contingent of Canadians to not only represent our country, but to assist in the actual operation of command and control of joint air forces in the surveillance of, and if necessary, the defense of our territory. NORAD, 21st NORAD region, was that northeast section of the continental United States, which went from roughly Cape Cod right the way through to the southern part of Nova Scotia. And so there was probably more U.S. territory than Canadian territory in the area of responsibility. And within that area, we had a number of radar stations, including one in Nova Scotia, that we jointly managed. I was deputy to a Brigadier General in the U.S. Air Force, and our teams, Canadian and American, worked together 24 hours, 7 days a week to ensure that that sector of the North American Air Defense Region was properly monitored. visits to the radar units were frequently done. The radar units themselves were jointly manned, U.S. and Canadian personnel. There was relatively limited administrative responsibilities with regard to the Canadian membership in that region, although some liaison with our own National Defense Headquarters was required from time to time, directly and sometimes through head office of our contingent in Colorado Springs, the actual NORAD headquarters, then commanded by a three-star Canadian Air Force officer. Mm-hmm.
Did you have aircraft within the 21st region?
We had what I would call practice airplanes in the region headquarters. It still was typical for the American commanders and officers to maintain some flight capability, not necessary for the Canadian air crew associated, but within the region, yes, there were quite large numbers of fighter resources in our area. It was at Griffiths Air Force Base near Syracuse. Mm-hmm. Well, Rome, New York, in fact. And so it was that air defense resource that was most often scrambled by our agencies, in addition to Air National Guard resources in places like Niagara Falls.
21st Region went from Cape Cod and Nova Scotia. How far west?
It was west to Buffalo.
But to Buffalo. And can you tell me what the assessed threat was that 21st NORAD was reacting to, or hoping not to react to, perhaps?
Yes. Well, mostly from the northeast approaches to North America, and as you know, I'm sure, most of the commercial traffic comes in on a southwesterly route from, you know, the Europe. bring him down on a track which would be very similar to that which might be taken by Russian bombers, and in fact Russian bombers were sometimes intercepted off the coast of Newfoundland. some of those interceptions conducted completely by, of course, the Canadian sector, and on occasion we would have to scramble our own resources to participate in any uncertain tracks coming in from that direction. So there was, you know, very close coordination with the northern region that was at North Bay, Ontario, and had jurisdiction over that part of northeastern Canada.
Did NORAD at that time have any ability to track objects in space?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, that was one of their responsibilities in NORAD headquarters. For us in the regions, it was not a matter of great concern, although reporting came down to us from what was accumulated in information at NORAD headquarters, Colorado Springs, but certainly space became more and more of an issue during those years in the late 70s. And
so as far as the threat, as you saw it, you mentioned the bombers, Soviet bombers, off the coast of Newfoundland.
That was it from the standpoint of North American air defense. Mm-hmm. Not to say that there weren't other elements who were concerned about the maritime approaches, but that was generally handled by SACLANT, not by NORAD.
So did 21st NORAD go over the water or just over land?
Oh no, there were sectors included waters off the northeast coast of the United States and Nova Scotia.
In 1977, 78, 79, the intercontinental ballistic missile threat was fairly great.
Yes, oh yes. It.
What was 21st NORAD able to do about that?
And as I say, we did not have a specific missile tracking nor concern. That was done from Colorado Springs.
Okay. And did you have a chance to go to Colorado Springs?
Oh, indeed, yes. It was necessary to make occasional visits to the headquarters. Our commander would sometimes just bring in the Canadian contingent or representatives of the Canadian contingents for some matters. In others, it was a matter of representing the region in a regular conference. For me, one of the most enjoyable aspects of our NORAD headquarters was the conduct of what we called community leaders indoctrination tours, and every region did a similar program of education of business leaders, in our case the city of New York, Syracuse, as to what NORAD was established for and what it was doing today and the prospects for the future.
So what would happen during a community leaders session?
Well, we would take an aircraft from Syracuse that was probably a contingent of 20 senior leaders, including the mayor or alderman, etc., of the local community, and take them to Colorado Springs for a day or two of briefings, visit to the headquarters in the mountain.
Hmm. Connected to the last question, in 1987, retired Major General Leonard Johnson published A General for Peace, in which he states that his view of the nuclear arms race had been jolted by a visit to NORAD headquarters in Colorado. Did you know Major General Johnson?
Indeed, I did.
How did you know him?
Well, we were associates in the Air Transport Command for a number of years, And in fact, subsequently, when I was commander of our air transport group in Trenton, General Johnson had become co-located with our headquarters, was training command headquarters, and he was commander of that.
Okay.
Training Systems Command.
Right. And he was in NORAD before or after you?
No, he simply went on a visit to NORAD. He wasn't a member.
He went on a visit. That's
yeah.
Right. Do you remember when his book came out, or any of his revelations came out?
I have not read his book, but I'm sure that, like everything that he did, it was through personal conviction. He has some very strong ideas on what was right and what was wrong in military affairs.
In flying as well?
I less knowledgeable about that than his proclivities in peace groups.
Mm-hmm. Now, did he do peace group things while he was in the military?
No. He ended up as as many do, I think, becoming far more opinionated in the matter of military affairs as commander of the National Defense College, where the tendency is to look at the world in a much broader perspective than any other time in one's military career. Doesn't matter really whether it's Army, Navy, or Air Force. There is a tendency to become more broadly exposed to things that you had not previously been exposed to, and in his case, I believe that he became unduly concerned about the military-industrial complex and changed some of his attitudes about what the military should do.
We talked a little bit yesterday off after the tape, so I won't go into about that, but with General Johnson and with an admiral who's here, whose name escapes me at the moment, there's a tendency for senior officers to be able to speak out after they retire.
Yes, yes. Probably Admiral Chuck Thomas. Who has been very, very vociferous and quite the opposite to what General Johnson would.
Perhaps we'll talk later on about
yes.
How senior officers and general officers are able to speak only after they retire. For the last 18 months, 1982 to 84 of your distinguished career, you returned to NDHQ as the Director General of Current Policy. And this set you again in the arms control field during the Trudeau government. Can you tell me a bit about those days?
Well, they were rather discouraging days for the military generally. It's hard to blame any one government or individual for the disregard of military traditions and organizations and of the importance of maintaining a fairly strong military capability despite the continuing evidence of reducing tensions between East and West. We've had so many historical similarities of post-conflicts, whether it's hot conflicts or cold, reduction in concern about said conflicts. We don't have to be concerned about it anymore, so let's put our money in other things, whether it be bilingualism or of any other particular matter, health and welfare of our citizens. All of the very pressing priorities of government tend to divert the attention of senior leaders from the crisis that frequently causes them to switch towards military postures. And so during my time, certainly in the last couple of years in that position of current policy and National Defense Headquarters, we did have regular evidence that our recommendations to government were not being given much attention, and the need for white papers, as the term used to be, white papers on national defense, really were dependent on white papers on external affairs, and both areas were not getting the attention that were needed. Papers were presented but not agreed upon and put on the shelf for another conference. So it was a little discouraging, as I said, to be in the headquarters at that time. And I do want to give great credit, as I think I did previously, to the hard work of people in external affairs to try to keep government on track in these matters. But we both of our departments had difficulty in that respect.
What did your duties at Director General of Current Policy, what sort of current policies did that include?
Well, it was really operational matters of, as I said, arms control was still one of them, continental defense was another, international agreements another. And so I would be involved at one stage in meetings in NATO with regard to the NATO AWACS, Airborne Command Control System, and what part Canada would play in that. Would Canada contribute air crew or some capital amount to acquire the right kind of airplanes for the job? Which airplane was the right airplane to do? The British had one version and the Americans had another. Those were interesting negotiations, but like so many other things in NATO, not just in Canada-U.S. relations, but NATO was probably worse in attempting to find some consensus on where do we go from here. So interesting conferences, but again, a good deal of threshing of the water.
Mm. But the CF-18 was purchased in that time.
Yes, we did have a good aircraft program, thanks to some compromise on the part of many, that it be what basically was a naval airplane, that it be adapted and made suitable for the Canadian forces. had our Air Force had its druthers, I think, and the money not have been such a difficult matter, the F-15 would have been the preference of the traditional air defense people.
Would that have been your, or you weren't, you've been in air defense.
Well, yes, the air defense in those days is considerably different from the latter days. There was one aspect of the F-15 program that some of our own Air Force people weren't completely happy with, and that is that it was a single-seater. We had become somewhat accustomed to, since CF-100 days, to a two-seater airplane with a pilot and navigator, or really an air weapons controller in the back seat of the CF-100, and likewise in the Voodoo. So there was a great contingent of Air Force who said it had to be a two-seater airplane. So, as I say, we developed a compromise in aircraft type, and the F-18 really filled the bill quite well.
Isn't it single seat?
No, it's There are single seat F-18s. Yes, of course. But the air weapons controller really was superseded by technology. It became possible with the new avionics for one person to handle all of the target acquisition and tracking responsibilities that the AI used to have.
There was, during those days when you were at current policy, I seem to recall that air-launched cruise missiles were going to be tested in Canada. Was that part of current policy?
Yes. We had a number of ministerial inquiries on the subject. It was of great concern to many organizations in Canada who thought that it would be an aggressive step for us to permit that kind of testing. But there was little doubt in our headquarters that it was not a matter of Canadian environmental concern. It was a missile that would be launched from offshore, from Alaska or wherever, just simply transiting over territory very similar to that which would have to be transited in the case of use over the Soviet Union. And there was an excellent example of the proper Canadian-American coordination to develop a system that was going to be to our mutual benefit.
And so I think it went ahead, didn't it?
Oh, yes.
Was that under NORAD?
That was the
testing, or
was
it?
No, it was really a Strategic Air Command program.
Now, you mentioned that arms control negotiations were part of current policy shop.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. My understanding of the Trudeau government was that he was in favor of arms control negotiations.
Oh, indeed. We had very little difficulty in that respect. No, our difficulty was probably far more so in getting approval of other countries for the reduction in the need for certain types of weapons. I think I mentioned them previously as those types of things that are generally a bit indiscriminate on who gets injured and or killed, such as landmines and napalm weapons and CLBUs.
CLBU?
Well, that's cluster bombs.
Cluster bombs. Mm-hmm. This question's a bit off our topic of the early Cold War, but you said yesterday that you'd like to be asked something about this, so I did some research. I think it's important to your story. In the Globe and Mail of April 12, 1980, there was a story about women being allowed to serve on Canadian Forces ships. On July 10, 1980, the Winnipeg Free Press reported that Royal Military College would admit women for the first time. And on February 14, 1981, the Winnipeg Free Press reported that the first women had passed flight training at Moose Jaw. You were a general officer during all these events. Tell me about the role of women in the Canadian Forces.
Yes, well, I think that it probably was far more delayed than it should have been. I think it was probably 1979, prior to leaving North American Air Defense region in Syracuse, that I was included in a conference of Air Force senior officers to study that very question, when would it be appropriate to introduce women into combat roles, if ever, and which quotation marks combat roles would be suitable. And at that time, knowing that I was going to Air Transport Group headquarters, I said that my group would be pleased to have women pilots anytime. Hmm. And in fact, it was their transport into which they first went in an operational sense.
Yeah. Did you take heat over that?
Yes, to some degree. I was one of the few who agreed in that matter.
What were the arguments against?
Well, I think one of the things about military service is that you have a number of occasions when privileges are a bit limited when you're traveling in particular. It's far less so in transport operations than in fighter operations. far less so in some fighter operations than in helicopter operations. And so you can see the potential for a built-in limitation on where it was going to be suitable for women to be subjected to those rather limiting personal conditions that one is in. It's, you know, just imagine the problems of the soldiers and having women beside them in the trenches, probably the most deprivating conditions imaginable. There are almost similar conditions in other areas. Submarines would be another very critical matter. It was considered to be one of the unmentionable conditions for women in service. but then helicopter pilots who are supporting armies in the field frequently find themselves also cheek by jowl in trenches under fire. And so, you know, where is the dividing line, or if there should be any dividing line at all? So that dividing line has moved considerably since those days, I'm glad to say, and they are now accepted partners in every walk of operations. I'm very pleased to hear our commander from Afghanistan yesterday say that the women serving in Kabul did an outstanding job in every task that they were put to, and he has no hesitation about recommending their use in any operational field.
So they're in Kabul now doing peacekeeping?
Well, peacemaking, I would call it.
Peacemaking?
Yeah. It's not quite the situation where you are where conflicting organizations welcome you. Mm-hmm. You're in a situation where some are very much against you being there at all, and you're under threat on a daily basis.
And just for the staying on the topic of women in the early days in the Air Force, so air transport accepted women through your auspices. How about the fighter business?
They certainly were. And are now employed in every aspect of air operations. Mm-hmm. gradually, it moved from air transport to the other fields. I think training systems or pilot training and related were next. Search and rescue helicopters were next. And, you know, it gradually moved into the entire fields.
Sort of based on the level of accommodation?
And proof of capability, there's no doubt about it. The ladies did an outstanding job of saying, we can do it. And they did it.
Was the origin of that in 78, 79 a government initiative or a military initiative?
No, I'd say that it was very much a government initiative. Equal rights was the order of the day.
I'll just give you this question and allow you to comment. Should Canada maintain a robust military-industrial complex even after the Cold War is over?
Yes. as a former vice president of the Canadian Defence Preparedness Association, I can still maintain that my convictions have not changed. we do need to have a very coherent foreign defense policy and national defense policy. National, not looking strictly at the defense of Canada, but Canada's role in the world and what part our military should play in the world. We cannot be isolated in either respect, foreign policy or defense policy. And Canada needs to have a robust defense industry, which in peacetime can be exercised in a variety of ways, that is, research and development activities, which keep it on the edge of technology, always looking to the application of those technologies in the defense field, and staying abreast of the defense technologies.
So aircraft, ships?
And all things associated with weapons and weapon systems.
Mm-hmm. Is that happening?
No, I'm afraid it is not. We have, to some extent, because of the space program, been able to stay fairly high in the participation of our industry. But there are some of those industries that are being lost to other offshore foreign establishments. And not to say that that in the big picture those establishments aren't needed, some of which of course are in Europe, and as long as we may remain part of a NATO or of an organization that is mutually committed to world assistance as and when necessary, an organization that now produces airplanes in France or in Europe generally can be as beneficial to us as one that does so in Canada, with the exception of the fact that we don't have employment of people in that industry. How long can we depend on all those close associations with foreign countries to be mutually beneficial? Sometimes one or other of them will break away, as I guess we've seen happen in the past. We were always a little bit concerned in NATO in the Cold War years when France broke away from the NATO military structure because they felt that the U.S. was taking too much of the supervision responsibility and consequently management of NATO was not to their advantage. And yet France maintained a very comprehensive capability within itself and now is contributing remarkably to the European Union defense posture. But as long as we can have that coherent multinational organization, then we should play our role, share in it. And I'm afraid that some things such as the opting out of the ballistic missile defense will work against our participation in some of the fields that we should stay abreast of.
Such as?
Well, electronics generally, space activities in particular. We do face some limitations in technical details whenever we choose not to participate in a very complex high technology program.
Mm-hmm.
Rightfully, our right to know is limited.
Mm-hmm. What would need to change today?
Well, today we would have to backtrack on some decisions that have already been taken. It's far harder to backtrack and regain the confidence of your associates in such fields. never too late, and that really is, I suppose, one of the arguments that I would make for doing a few things in foreign and defense policy that have been disregarded for too long. Relationships not just with the U.S. but with other countries with whom we are going to have to work.
Mm-hmm. We talked earlier about another general officer, and I was wondering, did you know General John Boyle, who was the Chief of Defense Staff and Air Force officer during the Somalia cover-up?
I did not know him personally, no.
How many senior general officers would you think are in Victoria these days, living in Victoria, retired?
Well, I suspect the climate is the attraction for most of us. Some retired naval officers probably more so because they have served here for many years. But I certainly know of, I guess, at least half a dozen Air Force officers who have come to Victoria because of the climate and, to some degree, the fact that other retired Air Force officers are here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another question I'd like to ask is about outspokenness of general officers while they're in the military and after they retire.
Yes. I I am one who believes that you should always speak your mind. And we have fallen into a pattern in post-war years of limiting the right, not only the willingness of people to speak out. Those who have spoken out in recent times have generally been dismissed rather rapidly for one reason or another. Others who failed to convince senior government officials or even senior military people that they had a strong argument to make contrary to the way things were going have resigned because they knew they were against a brick wall. And I think it's a shame that we've had that, but it is part and parcel of our system of government that the chiefs of services are responsible to a government agency, a government official, and when that government official refuses to listen to good advice, there is not much choice. Either the government official fires the individual whose opinion he does not agree with, or the individual leaves the service. I'm pleased to see from time to time, both in our own services and in the U.S. services, occasionally in other services, certainly at the time of the Bosnian conflict in Yugoslavia, there was a UK general who put his career on the line by disagreeing with a NATO commander. And he was not removed from service. He went on to be the chief of the general staff. So when you see individuals stand up for their convictions, it's always something to admire. And we just haven't had sufficient numbers of our own to do that. You know? Some have done it and have lost in one respect or another.
Are the cards stacked against the outspoken general officer?
Yes, I think they are. There are a great many restrictions, both in bureaucratic terms and in military terms. Each individual has his own limitations about how much flack he will take before he says enough, shut up. Yet when there are indications that a government official is not listening to good advice, and that advice is critical to our relationships with another country or with a potential critical war matter, then government officials do themselves have to be limited in what they can do to quieten a dissident voice. So I'm not sure that I can identify the specific cutoff and how far you go, but I do encourage the speaking of the truth and your convictions. And I'm pleased to say that General Hillier, the new Chief of the Defense Staff, seems to be that type of person.
Mm-hmm. And he's getting away with it?
Yeah.
Good. There was, I'm just going to flip the table.
I'm not sure it's right to say that he's getting away with it, but okay. You know, we have a more responsive understanding leadership in government.
So I see, I stand corrected, that it's not that General Hillier is getting away with anything.
No.
It's that his arguments are compelling.
That's right, and the time is right with this government to be less arbitrary than the previous government.
Just going to flip the tape over and for the next question.